From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross.
I mean, if you'd like to come visit me sometime, you're welcome to. At least there's some pretty country around where I live. Would you like to come visit me this Sunday?
Yes.
The new film, Carol, starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, is about two women who begin a love affair in the early 1950s. Today, we talk with the film's director, Todd Haynes, and its screenwriter, Phyllis Nagy. Also, former paramedic Kevin Hazard discusses his new memoir about responding to 911 calls for gunshot wounds, stabbings, cardiac arrests, car wrecks, ODs.
Ultimately, a paramedic is always outgunned. This could be a 400-pound person on a third-floor apartment with only stairs. And, you know, you realize, okay, we are not getting this guy out of here by ourselves. But in the meantime, he is in really acute distress.
And Ken Tucker reviews the new album by British pop singer Ellie Goulding. First, the news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. The new film Carol, about two women who fall in love in the early 1950s, swept the New York Film Critics Circle Awards for 2015. It won Best Picture and Best Cinematographer. Our guest, Todd Haynes, won for Best Director, and our other guest, Phyllis Nagy, won for Best Screenplay. Haynes also directed I'm Not There, Far From Heaven, and the HBO adaptation of Mildred Pierce. Nagy is an American-born playwright who has done most of her work in England. She adapted the screenplay for Carol from the novel The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith, who is best known for her novels Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley. But unlike those books, The Price of Salt was written under a pseudonym because it was about a lesbian love affair. The movie is set in New York, where a young woman, an aspiring photographer named Therese, is working in the toy section of a department store. She sells a train set to a beautiful, elegantly dressed, affluent woman named Carol. After Carol leaves her gloves behind on the counter, Therese tracks her down to return the gloves, and they slowly begin an affair. Carol is played by Cate Blanchett. Therese by Rooney Mara. Terry spoke with Haynes and Nagy last Wednesday and began with this scene from the film.
So I'm sure you thought it was a man who sent you back your gloves.
I did. Thought it might have been a man in the ski department.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm delighted. I doubt very much I would have gone to lunch with him.
Oh, your perfume.
Yes.
It's nice.
Thank you. Harge bought me a bottle years ago, before we were married, and I've been wearing it ever since.
Harge is your husband?
Mm-hmm. Well, technically, we're divorcing.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. And you live alone, Therese Balavet?
I do. Well, there's Richard. He'd like to live with me. Oh, no, it's nothing like that. I mean, he'd like to marry me.
I see. And would you like to marry him?
Well, I barely even know what to order for lunch.
That's Rooney Mara and Cate Blanchett. Todd Haynes and Phyllis Nagy, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film. Phyllis, let me start with you, since the story of this adaptation starts with you. What is the importance of the novel that Carol's adapted from? What's its importance in the history of gay and lesbian fiction? And it was written by Patricia Highsmith under a pseudonym and published in 1952.
Yes, and as far as I am aware, it was the first relatively mainstream lesbian novel to be published that included not only a relatively happy ending, but it did not include the death of one of its lesbian heroines or one of them going to an insane asylum or nunnery. And it fully embraced the notion that sexuality was a thing that did not in and of itself cause guilt to the people who were experiencing sexuality as opposed to contemplating it, which a lot of prior lesbian fiction had done. So it's extremely forward-thinking in that way.
Before I bring Todd into the conversation, Phyllis, I'm going to ask you to describe the two main characters in Carol.
Well, the two main characters in Carol are Thérèse Bellavet, a young, aspiring photographer in the film, an aspiring theatrical set designer in the novel. She is at a stage in her life, early 20s, where she is searching for the keys to her future. She's a bit reticent. She's immensely curious, a bit like a sponge, and responds to everything with an alarming honesty, much like Pat Highsmith herself, whom I knew. So Thérèse is her alter ego. Carol Aird is older, married, and she is a melancholy creature.
Todd Haynes, let me bring you into the conversation. You directed the new film, Carol. Cate Blanchett is Carol, the older, more affluent woman. Rooney Mara is the young woman who's like working class. Carol dresses like elegantly. Rooney Mara's character, Thérèse, doesn't really care much about clothes and doesn't dress particularly fashionably at all. They also, it seems to me, have really different acting styles in the movie. The Cate Blanchett character of Carol, she has this really like modulated, breathy kind of voice and speaks in a way that actresses speak, especially in 50s movies, you know, in the, it's like musical way. And Rooney Mara's character is much more like naturalistic, almost like Natalie Wood just stepped into the movie in the 1950s, you know. And I'm wondering if you saw it that way at all, as like two different acting styles representing two different types of women, two different types of actresses, two different types of styles.
Well, yeah, certainly there's sort of defining differences between these two women, which begins with their age differences and their class differences. And the fact that, and this begins in the novel, the way Thérèse is so enthralled by what kind of woman, the kind of depiction and representation of femininity that Carol represents, to a degree that she says, I myself could probably never achieve. And there's something, as Phyllis so perfectly describes in Carol, the character, there's something unhappy. There's something mercurial about this woman. There's a, she's sort of disinclined toward happiness or spontaneity. But I think what we have the opportunity to see in a character like Carol is the facade, the alluring surfaces of this woman that immediately draws and attracts Thérèse. And then the sort of layers begin to fall away. And you start to see a very complicated and conflicted person underneath that. And you see her taking a curious leap, both of them, out of their worlds to the other, you know, almost against all logic. And I think there's something so lovely about that being the way love often begins, in the most irrational, inexplicable sort of circumstances where you put yourself out there and you keep going, what am I doing? Where am I? Why am I here? But you keep going back.
Carol was written under a pseudonym. Patricia Highsmith wrote it under the name Claire Morgan. Patricia Highsmith was not out when she wrote this novel in the early 1950s. Was Highsmith afraid that if she used her own name, that she would be outed and that it would ruin her career? Phyllis, this one's for you.
No, she actually was about as out as anyone could be at that time. It was well known that she was a lesbian. In fact, she wouldn't have minded publishing it under her own name, but first, the publisher of Strangers on a Train, they asked her to consider getting another publisher for The Price of Salt. Though they wouldn't have used this word then, it was not the brand. It was not the Highsmith brand. She agreed to do it.
The Highsmith brand was a crime novel at that point.
Crime novel, which, of course, Carol is not a crime novel, but it does have elements of criminal in it. So it was still a Highsmith novel,
had they thought about it. There is a gun.
There is a gun. There is an air of menace. There is paranoia, all of those things.
Phyllis, how did you get to know Patricia Highsmith?
Well, I was working as a fact checker researcher at the New York Times at the end of the 80s for what were then the Part Two magazines, World of New York, Sophisticated Traveler. And the editors of World of New York wanted to commission a crime writer or a mystery writer to do a walking tour of Greenwood Cemetery. And one of the names that I suggested was Pat Highsmith, who happened to be in New York, and she agreed to go. So the editors sent me to accompany Pat Highsmith to the cemetery, which was quite a strange trip through the rain and Pat being reticent and very Therese-like, poking sticks at graves and only exclaiming when she saw the grave of Lola Montez. I guess that was one of her faves. And this trip culminated in a gruesome tour of the crematorium. And at the end of this horrible tour, it was about 11 a.m., and we went outside and Pat produced a hip flask from her trench coat and said, "I don't know about you, but I need a drink." And she held this flask out to me like a challenge. And I thought, well, what the hell? And I took it, and it was scotch at 11 a.m., which led to an invitation to lunch, which also consisted mostly of alcohol. And from then on in, we became first incredible correspondents. We wrote letters. Later, when I moved to Europe, I saw her much more frequently.
So did Patricia Highsmith know that you were a lesbian and you were about 22 at this time? Did you know?
Pat seemed to know an awful lot about me when I picked her up in the lobby of the Gramercy Park Hotel, so I'm sure that was one of the things that she did know. She was very good at research herself. And I knew from the cradle, so it was not a secret. So, yes, she did know, and I knew fairly early myself.
Were there things you were able to learn during your 10-year friendship with Patricia Highsmith about what it was like to be gay in the early 1950s, which is when Carol is set, things that you could later use in your adaptation of the novel?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think what I learned from Pat about being gay in the 50s, and from friends of hers that she introduced me to, it was a window on a very particular subset of lesbians. Pat herself, I always like to say, was like the studio boss of lesbians. In that she was right there chasing women around couches and throwing them down onto beds and four-posters and gauzy things. And I thought at first that she was probably just, you know, pumping up her own reputation as a lesbian stud. But in fact, her peers, the women that she chased, many of whom actually did remain friendly with her, confirmed those stories. These women were vaguely of the Carol Aird set. So I felt as if I knew exactly who Carol Aird was.
Well, let me stop you there. So you're saying the women that she chased were like affluent, suburban, married women with fur coats? Tell me where I'm going wrong here.
Yes, many married women, in fact, because I think the married women suited Patricia Highsmith, who famously did not like to live with people or have that kind of attachment that most reasonable people after a time expect that there will be this form of commitment. With married women, that was rarely possible. So they were I'd say the Euro equivalents of wealthy, suburban, mostly married, and secretive. women who probably in 1952 were on prototypes of antidepressants and drank a lot and smoked a lot, like Highsmith herself.
You said that Highsmith liked to collect young women and be their mentor. Did she want to cast you in that role? You were 22 when you met.
Yeah. It's a funny thing. There was a moment when we were out in a restaurant together and she took out this billfold, like an old-fashioned wallet billfold full of plastic pictures that kind of flipped down accordion style. And she said, "Look at this." And I did, and they were pictures of women, young women, dressed in sort of S&M leathers and studs and peaked caps and gloves and posing on chairs a la Dietrich in The Blue Angel. And so I said to Pat, "Oh, who are these? Are these your relatives?" Or And she said, "No, they're the young women I send books to." I said, "Oh, that must be nice for them," or some idiotic thing like that. And she looked at me and she said, "I don't suppose you're one of these, are you?" And I said, "No, I don't suppose I am." And that was the end of that. I think I think she knew that I was not somebody who was looking to be showered with gifts or to make a bargain that included not sex. I think by this time in her life, she was not sexual anymore, nor was she sexual with these other young women. But I think the bargain struck was respect me, respect me, and in turn I will provide you with my reading list of essential material. She knew that I already respected her, that there was no need to buy that in any way, shape, or form. And plus, it was just all too ridiculous to contemplate. You know, I would have looked like Darla from The Little Rascals in high heels and a fur coat.
Phyllis Nagy and Todd Haynes speaking with Terry last Wednesday. Haynes directed the new film Carol. Nagy adapted the screenplay. Coming up, we'll hear more of their conversation. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by British pop singer Ellie Goulding. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Squarespace, with tools to bring ideas to life online, covering domains, hosting, e-commerce, and other services, all with 24/7 customer support at squarespace.com/NPR. Squarespace, build it beautiful. And from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview about the new movie, Carol. Our guests are the film's director, Todd Haynes, and the screenwriter, Phyllis Nagy. Carol is about an affair between a young working-class woman, played by Rooney Mara, and an older, affluent suburban woman, played by Cate Blanchett. The movie is adapted from the 1952 novel The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith.
Todd, you came onto this project after the ball was rolling. The screen adaptation was written. Cate Blanchett was already cast. Another director had signed up initially, but then took another project instead. Did you have any reservations when you became attached to the film about being a man directing a movie about a relationship between two women? And I ask that because we're living in an era where people take offense so easily that if you're not the right gender or race or ethnic group to tell a joke or tell a story, then you don't have the right to own it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes. No, I did not. I mean, or at least what I felt was this was a tremendous, beautiful opportunity for me to explore this story as a gay man and as somebody who's been in love and who's been in Therese's shoes in life and in ways that I wanted to make available to many other people who could go see this film, because I felt like I had that common and universal and poignant experience in my own history, you know, in my own memory, and that's what's so unsentimentally and beautifully described in the novel to begin with, and which Phyllis went running with in her adaptation. And I have to say, like, so many of my dearest, closest friends in the world are gay women.
Phyllis, Patricia Highsmith's novel, The Price of Salt, which you adapted into the film Carol, has some autobiographical aspects for her. In the story, Therese is a young woman working in a department store when Carol, the older, more affluent woman, walks in, buys a toy from her for her young daughter, and leaves her gloves. Carol leaves her gloves on the counter. And Therese has Carol's address because she needed to write it down to have the train set that she was buying shipped to her home. Therese sends the gloves back to Carol. Carol calls Therese to thank her for sending the gloves and invites her out to lunch. And that's how they really get to know each other. A similar thing happened to Patricia Highsmith in a department store. Phyllis, what was the similar incident?
Pat was working at Bloomingdale's, I think, as a temp over a Christmas holiday. And
in order to pay for her therapy.
Right.
She was a psychiatrist.
Yes.
Because of a heterosexual relationship, she
wasn't.
Yeah,
she had dabbled. And the dabbling was really not going very well, hence the therapist. Anyway, this blonde woman, as Pat once described her to me, and made her sound like a Hitchcock blonde. With a heart of ice and a dirtiness about her. And I thought, wow, you just saw that across the department store floor. They did not, in fact, meet for lunch or have any real human interaction following that meeting, except that Pat did research her, as she did research many people. And I suppose you could even say that she stalked her a little bit without this woman knowing it. And that was that.
So Patricia Highsmith was in therapy at about this time. Was this an attempt to convert herself to heterosexuality or to just understand why she had briefly gotten into a heterosexual relationship?
Well, I don't think we can know that, but having known Pat a bit, I think she was quite logical. Again, a bit like Therese, trying to fully understand why her nature warred within herself. The unwholesome truth about Pat is that she was a lesbian who did not very much enjoy being around other women. So the attempt to dabble with one man seriously, and perhaps a few others along the way, was to just see if she could be into men in that way, because she so much more preferred their company. Pat would have been a great member of Sterling Cooper, Mad Men. and really, I think that was the formative psychological trait, and she carried this with her throughout her life, that she really didn't like women. She liked to have sex with them, and she liked them to go home and shut up, but she much preferred the company of males.
It sounds like some men of the period.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so interestingly, too, I mean, her, so much of what she really is known for, better known for, are these male criminal subjects in Ripley, Bruno in Strangers on a Train, where homoeroticism is sort of the unspoken engine mm-hmm. that the criminal act is the manifestation of. And so there's this real questionable, fascinating sort of pathology around gay male homosexuality as the sort of underpinning of criminal activity. And it drives so many of these stories. It's almost, you know, in every almost in every one I've read, you feel that. And so this is the only book she wrote, Price of Salt, that's about homosexuality from a that it's not a pathological depiction, and it's between women.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you, Terry, very much.
Todd Haynes and Phyllis Nagy spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Todd Haynes directed the new film, Carol. Phyllis Nagy wrote the screenplay. Ellie Goulding is a 29-year-old British singer who has been much more popular in the UK than here. She first became known in the electronic dance music genre. But our rock critic Ken Tucker says her new album, Delirium, represents a shift into mainstream pop and, hopefully, a bigger U.S. following.
You're the light, you're the night, you're the color of my blood. You're the cure, you're the pain, you're the only thing I want to touch. Never knew that it could mean so much, so much. You're the fear.
Chances are you may know that song, Love Me Like You Do, more readily than you know its singer, Ellie Goulding. The song appeared on the 50 Shades of Grey soundtrack album and is probably the British singer's most well-known work in America thus far. Goulding specializes in singing about romantic yearning in a clear voice with crisp enunciation. It's a vocal style that has enabled her to stand out when what she was making was primarily beat-dominated dance music. This time around, she's going for something different.
Gotta love this field in the cherry sky. Under blossom clouds, though it's late July. You don't even try, still you look so cool. Like a cover boy when you light the
That's Lost and Found, another song from Delirium, her new album. Goulding has said of Delirium, "Part of me views this album as an experiment to make a big pop album." She made her initial splash overseas by combining EDM, electronic dance music, with tremulous folk music vocalizing. On the new album, she's placed her faith in producers like Max Martin and Greg Kurstin, pop masterminds who've designed hits for people like Katy Perry, Kelly Clarkson, and Pink. The result for Goulding is frequently startling in a good way. Listen to the fast, jittery song called Around You, unlike anything she's ever done.
Yes.
Goulding sings with a lot of range, and frequently on Delirium, her producers deploy that range by multi-tracking her vocals recorded in various registers. One of the ways her move toward pop music manifests itself here is in the subject matter of the songs. She doesn't always stick with tunes about loving and losing love. Sometimes she revs up an anthem of reassurance, like this one, Don't Panic. Bye, down. There's a trap for any performer placing his or her voice in the service of grand pop productions like the ones Max Martin and others have designed for Goulding here. The singer can get lost in the vastness of the soundscapes that have been created to make her seem all-seeing, all-knowing. Then, too, you don't title an album Delirium without recognizing you're prizing mind-clouding passion over serious rational thought. But each time I listen to this album, I hear Ellie Goulding's phrasing, the sharp precision of her tone as the guiding factor in any given song. Her experiment, as she likes to call it, was worth the risk. It pays off with fresh inventiveness.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Ellie Goulding's new album, Delirium. Coming up, a former paramedic reflects on 10 years of emergency medicine. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Visit St. Petersburg Clearwater, offering 35 miles of white sand beaches along Florida's Gulf Coast, and cultural attractions including St. Pete's Dolly Museum and the Chihuly Collection. More at visitstpeteclearwater.com. And from Squarespace, providing website and e-commerce tools to build brands. Customers receive built-in SEO, marketing analytics, and mobile optimization. Learn more at squarespace.com/NPR. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David B. Cooley, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, Kevin Hazard, practiced medicine in streets, bathrooms, living rooms, elevators, construction sites, and even a rooftop. He revived people who had OD'd, helped rescue people whose bodies were shattered by car accidents, tried to bring back people whose hearts had stopped, delivered babies, and had to deal with unusual cases, like a guy who had intentionally nailed himself to the wall. He became an EMT, or emergency medical technician, in 2004 in Atlanta, and then became certified as a paramedic. Before working as an EMT, Hazard graduated from the Citadel Military College and then worked as a reporter at a daily in Marietta, Georgia. He's now a freelance writer and is writing for TV. Hazard spoke with Terry last Tuesday. His new memoir is titled, A Thousand Naked Strangers.
Kevin Hazard, welcome to Fresh Air. So before we talk about your work as an EMT and as a paramedic, can you just tell us a little bit the differences between what an EMT can do and what a paramedic can do?
Generally speaking, the EMT is, you know, the junior member of the ambulance duo. You know, they can start IVs, they can bandage, they can splint, they can do CPR. There are a few medications that they can give. And, you know, that training is anywhere from 6 to 9 months. Whereas a paramedic is an additional 18 months. And that's where you get into the medications, the intubation, cardiology, you know, being able to work the, you know, those famous, you know, paddles, clear, pop. So the paramedic is a much more involved level. And, you know, the strange thing about it is that a paramedic has more autonomy than anyone other than a physician. So it's a really weird job because you get there and there's kind of nowhere for you to go. I mean, you could, you know, some people go to become a nurse for money or, you know, the stability of working for a hospital, but that's such a different job that, you know, it's not comparable in any way. So paramedic is really a very interesting place to be.
So you were told that it was your responsibility to answer any call, even if somebody was calling because they had a toothache, even if somebody was trying to, like, freeload and get, like, a ride downtown, it was your duty to answer the call. Did you get a lot of people who really should not have been calling an ambulance?
I can hear 10,000 paramedics around the country banging their hands on tables right now. Yeah, that's really common, you know. Someone decides, hey, I need a ride to an appointment at the hospital. They'll call 911 and say they have chest pain or even, you know, something simple like, oh, my foot hurts, I need to go. You know, and then there are people who, they're just kind of looking for attention. They're a little bit lonely. They're, you know, kind of a little bit hapless. But, you know, they'll call for a nightmare. They'll wake up, oh, my chest was really beating hard. Well, what was going on? Well, I just had this crazy nightmare and I woke up and my chest was really beating hard. You know, and if that person wants to go, you got to take them. That's just the way the law is written in Fulton County, regardless of why you call. So we would go out to people with nightmares or a toothache, which you try to explain, hey, you know, this isn't going to end well for you. You're going to spend 12 hours in a waiting room and then get sent home with a referral to a doctor's appointment. But they'll try their luck.
So of all the types of calls that you would get, is there a most typical one?
I think it probably depends on where you live. What I understand from friends, they say chest pain was the most common thing in New York City. In Atlanta, I think it's a mixture of our climate, you know, some of the aging buildings, the population, respiratory calls are really, really common, which was great because, you know, there are a few things that you can do outside of the hospital to take someone from near death to looking at you and saying, do I still need to go? And respiratory is one of those calls. And so, you know, that we ran so many of them on everything from infants to the elderly was great. You know, everybody thinks shooting is exciting. Oh man, I'm going to run this shooting. It's crazy. There are cops there and police helicopter and it's madness, but there's really nothing for you to do. That's really a job for the surgeons. Whereas a respiratory call, you know, that person is in acute distress, and they are going to die. You can see it in their face, and they know it, and you know it. And you just happen to have this bag full of tricks that you get to kneel on their floor and talk to them and calm them down and slowly begin to give them one medication after another. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you throw the book at them, and they're still just as about dead as when you found them. But oftentimes you can make a huge difference in that person's life, and it's both rewarding and exciting because, I mean, you wouldn't be there if you didn't want to open your bag and start throwing medicine at people.
You had to treat a lot of overdoses, and I learned some interesting things about overdoses reading your book. Like, I never really understood what made a speedball so potent when the heroin starts to wear off. So, you know, a speedball is a combination of heroin and cocaine. Would you describe why that can be not only a deadly mix, but a really difficult high in the long run.
Yeah, heroin and cocaine have different half-lives, I guess you could say. And so taken in combination, it's sort of, you know, somehow this crazy mix of up plus down, which gives you even, which is probably where most of us live anyway. But it's a distorted version of even. And the heroin, unfortunately, wears off faster. So people have a tendency to be living this, you know, nice, happy high, and then all of a sudden the heroin's gone, and you've got a head full of cocaine. And, you know, anyone who's had any experience around people who have done it, you can see right away that that has a tendency to get kind of ugly toward the end. And so at the end of this high, when someone's been up all night and, you know, it's been really great, all of a sudden it's just grinding teeth and sweat and anxiety and frustration, and they're really high on top of it. And, you know, that leads to, usually leads to them getting kind of violent and angry.
So is that when you're called in? Like, at what point were you called in for speedball overdoses? Or is that when they're totally, like, knocked out and perhaps dying?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, the worst was if you had someone who'd taken too much heroin. So, you know, because if it's just the right mixture, what we would be called in is the point at which the high turns ugly. And you have this guy who's kind of rampaging in his house or in his apartment or, you know, down the street. I mean, in the mall, there's all kinds of, you know, people's high turn bad on all kinds of places. But the one that can be the trickiest is the person who's overdosed. So you arrive and they have all the signs of a heroin overdose. And so you have Narcan, which immediately reverses some of the effects, basically the central nervous system effects of the heroin. So the heroin, when there's too much of it, it essentially tells your brain, hey, you know, there's just no reason to breathe. Just relax. You're good. And then that's how people, you know, that's how people die. And so you show up, there's a guy with needles, brown powdery substance, he's blue, and you think, oh, heroin overdose, this is no big deal, I've done this 10,000 times. And you give him some Narcan, thinking, hey, I'm just going to make him breathe. Now the heroin's gone, and all that cocaine is still there, and he pops up, and he's like, hey, what'd you do to my heroin? And now you've got this very large, very angry, very confused person running around with a head full of coke, and it, you know, and you're usually in the back seat of a car, or crammed into a tiny little bathroom, or a bathroom stall in a restaurant, and all of a sudden this person pops up, and invariably they are bigger than you and stronger than you, and they're half naked and sweaty, so you can't get a grip anyway, and those get ugly in a hurry.
Just when you were expecting a thank you.
Well, that's always the case. Just as you're expecting a thank you, someone says, hey, when you pulled me off that balcony that I was dangling from, you ripped my shirt.
Seriously? Did someone tell you that?
Yeah. Early one morning, I arrive, my partner, we get a call for a person dangling from a balcony, and she pulls the ambulance too close. And so we're both looking up at this person dangling directly above us. I said, you got to back up. If she drops, she's going to land on us. So she backs up, and I jump out. I think she was on the third floor. So this cop and I run upstairs, all, you know, ding, 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 three flights of stairs, get up there, find her door, locked, of course. So we kick it down, which is not easy to do. It's a new apartment building. It's a big steel door. We get inside, find her, luckily still dangling. We grab her, drag her over the edge, sedate her, because she was really high, get her tied down to our stretcher, bring her to the hospital. And the next morning when I showed up at work, the supervisor pulled me aside and said, hey, you remember that girl from last night? I said, yeah. I said, yeah, she's coming after us for $75 for a torn blouse.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Kevin Hazard, and we're talking about the 10 years that he spent as an EMT and then as a paramedic. Now he's written a memoir called 1,000 Naked Strangers. 1,000 Naked Strangers, were most most of the people who you had to meet naked?
A lot of them are. These kind of things never happen at a convenient moment. You know, there's no, like, good time to get in a car wreck or to get hurt. And so especially people at home, you know, you catch them in all kinds of compromising positions. And then there's just the huge range of people that, for whatever reason, you know, whether it's mental illness or, you know, just had way too much fun last night, find themselves out in the street partially or completely naked and need to be dealt with in one way or another. So there's, yeah, literally there are many people naked, but metaphorically, you know, also practically all of them are.
You were frequently called into housing projects to deal with emergency medical situations. And I'm wondering if people responded to you, and I'm talking about projects where there was a lot of drugs and a lot of crime, a lot of weapons, and I'm sure a lot of suspicion about the police. Since you're arriving in a uniform and in an official vehicle, were you seen as the kind of authority that people were suspicious of? Were people ever hostile to you? Or were you seen as the medical person coming to the rescue, and did you get a lot of respect?
Mostly the latter. For the most part, that was what you got. And even, you know, there are a few houses that I walked into, you could tell immediately that I'm surrounded by bad people, that these are dangerous people. You just, it's a weird vibe that you get in a room full of people who are dangerous. And often they were, you know, would try to help you out. And, oh, sure, you know, it's my uncle's house. Let me give you a hand. I'll help you carry him out. I think where things got ugly was when you had to flex your authority. And whether it was somebody saying, hey, I want him to go to this hospital and not this one, or no, I don't want him to go to the hospital, when you really felt that he did. And once you started to say, no, this is how we're going to have to do it, then suddenly you became, you know, oh, well, you're just another part of this enforcement machine. And you would see people's faces almost instantly change, and there's sort of light in their eyes that would go off, and then you realize, oh wow, this must be what it feels like to be a cop, you know, because you're trying to tell someone, hey, look, you guys have to